Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Got my mojo working, but just don't work on you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about nuts impacting your cholesterol, how vitamin K2 may protect against prostate cancer, how DHEA inhibits endothelial inflammation, that's a big one, and an interesting piece from Life Extension on coenzyme Q10, how it extends our lifespan, plus more on health and healing. Then we're going to take a look at some of the issues that most of the media do not talk about. We're going to talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and you hear Senator Elizabeth Warren talking about that. Then from Robert Reich, why Nike is the problem, not the solution. And yet the president is giving a speech promoting the Trans-Pacific Partnership at their corporate headquarters out in Oregon. Also, is the federal government harassing and censoring its own scientists for studying ties between pesticides and the massive death of bees? America's main problem today, corruption. Washington Blog, and more. And half of our program today will be Conversations with Remarkable Minds. Dr. Loretta Napoleoni. She's an expert on terrorist financing and money laundering and has advised governments and international organizations on counterterrorism. She is currently the chairwoman for the Club de Madrid, which brought heads of state together to create strategies to combat terrorist financing. We're going to talk about a deeper look at the Islamic State's mission at nation building and the creation of a postmodern caliphate in the 21st century, and how everything we're doing right now isn't going to work. So we're going to look at a different approach. On my next program, we're going to be talking about vaccine legislation in California and why it's very important that all the people who are listening to this program from California share the information. We have over 30 articles, all scientifically referenced. We have three major award-winning documentaries on vaccines. Watch them, share them with others, and we are point for point deconstructing the pro-vaccine arguments in the California legislation session out there. So by going to prn.fm or progressiveradionetwork.fm or just progressiveradionetwork.com, you'll be able to get all that information. We've got to put that into motion. Let's begin. We know that eating nuts, raw and organic, such as walnuts and almonds, or the butters made from them, like almond butter, walnut butter, and even one better than that, sprouted nut butter, where they sprout the nuts, which enhances their bioavailability and enhances their antioxidants, and then make it into a nut butter, and you refrigerate it or freeze it, and it stays for a long time, and it's great to put in your smoothies or as a snack. But and a lot of people just don't consume enough nuts. And one of the nuts they don't consume is the macadamia. But they should. According to the latest research, macadamia nuts contain a good quality saturated fat, high quality monounsaturated fatty acids. There was a 5-week study where men and women who had slightly elevated cholesterol were randomly assigned to the macadamia diet, meaning 1.5 ounces a day, that's a small amount, that's a teaspoon, or an average American diet, and total fat in the diet was the same. Only the percentages of saturated monounsaturated fats differed. At the end of 5 weeks, the macadamia diet was associated with a substantial reduction in both serum total cholesterol and the bad LDL cholesterol compared with the other group. So, clearly, adding nuts to our diet, especially macadamia nuts, can help you if you have elevated cholesterol. And that was published in the Journal of Nutrition. Your body is able to make a lot of hormones, but the older you are, the more challenging that becomes. you still make some. Even women who are postmenopause still produce estrogen. It's just not produced in the same way it was in the past through the ovaries. You have other ways in the body to produce it. Now, it's also true that your most important single hormone stimulator is DHEA. We've known about DHEA for a long time, but here's the latest on it, and this was from Vascular Pharmacology. It turns off inflammation, specifically in your endothelium. I have every year I have to get, for insurance purposes, I have to get a massive series of tests taken. Every test you can imagine I have to take. And one of them is a cardiovascular stress test. And the cardiologist and I have a little chat afterwards to go over the results, which are always good. And I asked him, I said, so let's say someone comes in here who has a problem. What do you recommend? He's, well, I'm going to put them on statins or I'm going... And I say, why? Look at all the side effects. And then here's what he says. He says, well, if a person was healthy, I wouldn't do that. I would recommend vitamin E and the omega fatty acids from fish oils and vitamin C. I would give them garlic and chlorophyll to keep their blood thin, and then there's no problem. And there's no medicine that could do that and be non-toxic to the body. Why don't you do it with all your patients? He said, because my experience has been that they're not going to change their lifestyle. They're just not. If they're drinkers, they're going to stay drinking. If they like the big steak, they're not going to cut it out. They want a simple solution. So the only solution I can give them is a drug. I said, but the drugs don't really work. The studies don't confirm they work, and they're very dangerous. He said, I'm aware of that. Now, be in my shoes and try to convince someone that if they don't change, they risk dying. And watch this look come across their face like, okay, I'm going to risk it. And it was interesting because when I was talking about the one thing that every single person seeing a cardiologist could do to prevent heart attack and stroke is heal the endothelium. Now, he agreed. And then I asked him, describe what causes the endothelium to become injured. Remember, it's only a single cell in your arteries. And he said, well, he said, and he made some comments. I said, well, you're partially correct. The rest of it is every single item you take into your body that's inflammatory, whether it's a liquid, like a soft drink, or sugar, or whether it's alcohol, or whether it's fried food, pizzas, fried chicken, barbecued ribs, all that creates tiny little scabs on the sensitive lining. And then that's on those scabs, they keep building, and that causes a plaque formation. So healing your endothelium is essential to having a healthy heart. So when you have blueberries and raspberries and strawberries and pomegranate and cherries, you're healing it because polyphenols heal it. When you're having a raw onion, the quercetin and the antioxidants heal the epithelium. When you're having garlic and shallots, that heals. When you're having sweet potatoes and kohlrabi and parsnips, the beta-carotene, heal the epithelium. And that's all correct. So the more living foods and juices that you consume, the healthier will be your arterial walls. Because the health of your heart is not just the heart. It's the environment in the entire cardiovascular system, which is your arteries. You want them to be pliable. You want them to be clean, no obstruction, and you want them to be healed. So now we can add one other thing at the top of the list, DHEA, because the latest study shows that DHEA significantly inhibited the subsequent production of inflammatory proteins ordinarily triggered by tumor necrosis factor alpha. Quote, directly inhibited the inflammatory process. A potential direct effect of DHEAS on vascular inflammation that has implications for development of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, end quote. You can buy DHEAS in any health food store. generally 15 to 20 milligrams. Very important. Now, another nutrient that's important is vitamin K2. We know it helps with the mineralization of your bones, but now we have something new. According to the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, this is a, from the European perspective, investigation of the cancer nutrition trial. It helps protect against prostate cancer. They looked at 11,000 men who were in the study and found that those taking vitamin K1 and 2 had the lowest incidence of prostate cancer. They were followed for 8.6 years. So it's a good study, large number of people followed for a long period of time. One more reason to take your vitamin K2, which most people don't take. Also, they found that olive oil is excellent as a preservative for the antioxidants. So let's say that you, and by the way, you find this everywhere in Europe, where you go into people's homes and you'll see jars and kegs and different types of containers that are filled with mushrooms and dried tomatoes and dried peppers and olives. And the liquid is always a very dark olive oil. And this study from Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry shows why and how. It's the omega-3 fatty acids. They're very powerful antioxidant, and they're great as a preservative. So that's good. Also, fish oil improves infants' cognitive and motor function. This was published in Journal of Pediatrics. So for all the women and men in this audience who have infants, if you expose them to DHA prenatally, you can improve their mental and motor development. And that's according to the Inuit and Arctic Quebec study. So DHA, if the mother takes it, passes it through in her breast milk to the baby, and before then, through her digestive system and her blood, and through into the fetus. So get your DHEA or DHA. How much? 500 milligrams a day would be outstanding. And finally, when it comes to coenzyme Q10, I'm doing some research now on seeing the actual science behind someone who's promoting a very low potency one, 5 milligrams, but it's supposed to be much better in the higher potency. I haven't seen the proof on that yet. I've asked for it, they just haven't sent it. Hopefully I'll get it. But regular coenzyme Q10, ubiquinone, is really good for your heart. It is my belief that if every American who has high blood pressure or any form of heart disease were to take 300 to 500 milligrams a day of coenzyme Q10 spread throughout the day, that we could substantially, meaning 50% or more, reduce the incidence of stroke or heart attack. Now, according to the mitochondrial theory of aging, and I've discussed this many times, the mitochondria are your energy factories. That's what actually combust. Let's say the adenosine triphosphate, the ATP, to create energy. Kind of look at your mitochondria as a wood-burning stove. You throw in the logs, and it burns, and heat comes out. So the same thing is true with the mitochondria. You have to give it the right nutrients. But oxidant damage to the mitochondria is at the root of aging itself. Simply put, the more oxidative damage to your mitochondria, the shorter you're going to live. It's that simple. Now, I was on the roster at the World Congress on Anti-Aging Medicine just 4 months ago in Las Vegas to present my paper on anti-aging based upon clinical studies I've done. And I'll give you the essence of it. We have a duality of similars, but with an awareness of what we can do to change this. Let me give you an example. When you drink any alcohol, for whatever reason, you're socializing, you're not intending to get drunk, you've created a massive, massive rush throughout your whole blood system, in every cell in your body, your eyes, your gums, your heart, your brain, your nervous system. And it's massively corrosive, it's highly acidic, and it is inflammatory. So you're creating what we call oxidative stress. The oxidative stress, in turn, causes all these different chemicals like free radicals, and those attack your cells, and a certain amount of cells will be damaged and others will be destroyed. And the most sensitive of these are the mitochondria. And the more the mitochondria you destroy, the shorter your life's going to be, because without energy, it's like having a car with no gasoline. You're not going to go anywhere. So therefore, if we can make the mitochondria burn energy more cleanly and efficiently, and if we can then de-accelerate the aging process, means we live longer. So in comes coenzyme Q10. It's an essential component of the mitochondria energy transfer system. So when your coenzyme Q10 levels are lower, mitochondria dysfunction skyrockets and aging accelerates. However, when coenzyme Q10 is added back to the aging mitochondria, it rebounds. And studies show that when supplemented with coenzyme Q10, older worms in the species of the C. elegans experience a slowing down of the aging process and extended lifespan. Well, even studies that don't show lifespan extension demonstrate a return to youthful behaviors and functions in response to coenzyme Q10 supplementation. And these benefits aren't restricted to primitive invertebrate. You can see it in so many other species, including humans. In fact, I had some rescued monkeys, and it takes a long time if they've been abused to get them to trust again and love again. And then you try to find them homes, which I've been successful in doing over my career. But two of them are sisters, and they couldn't be separated. And because they had their teeth removed early in their life, they have no way of defending themselves. So if they were put into a strange family, they'd be set upon and they could be killed. So I've had to nourish them and spend time with them. They normally live 12 to 15 years. Mine are 30 years old. I have some very long-lived creatures that I've worked with. And it's not that that's their normal lifespan. That's what happens when you really pay attention and look at their aging much like you look at your own. When you take in the right nutrients, you slow down your aging process. When you take in the wrong food and beverages, you speed it up. So giving them coenzyme Q10 is as important as giving it to yourself. You slow down the telomere exchange, and as a result, they live longer. There's no reason we shouldn't be living 20 years longer than what we're doing. But coenzyme Q10 also preserves your brain structure, and it slows neurodegeneration. Now, the mitochondrial dysfunction from chronic oxidation and the resulting chronic inflammation are a root cause of neurodegenerative conditions like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Huntington's, ALS. Coenzyme Q10 is important. Let me just give you an example. Let's take Alzheimer's. It's the largest cause of dementia among Americans. I'm guesstimating we have 5 million clinically diagnosed and another 10 million who have not yet been diagnosed because they have memory loss and loss of cognition, but no one's actually put them through the whole battery of tests yet. And we have an epidemic of this coming. I predict that within the next 10 years, we'll have 30 million Americans with Alzheimer's or dementia. 30 million. Now, while many factors contribute to the risk of Alzheimer's and aging, oxidative stress to the brain is at the top of the list. So accumulated oxidative stress, smoking, drinking, around polluting environments in the, you know, in the air, toxins in your water, all that leads to abnormal protein called amyloid B peptide, which is itself a trigger for more oxidation and inflammation. Eventually, brain cells overwhelmed by amyloid B peptide lose their function and die, producing loss of memory, cognition, and physical function we associate with disease. Now, coenzyme Q10 shows great promise in slowing this whole process down, or if done earlier, preventing it. And by slowing oxidative damage, coenzyme Q10 is proven to reduce deposition of destruction of amyloid B peptide proteins in brain cells. It reduces the amyloid B peptide, induce oxidation by contributing to the ability to quench the free radicals, and also coenzyme Q10 added to amyloid B peptide afflicted brain cell causes the destructive protein to become destabilized and weakened even after it is formed. So that's unique. I don't know any other nutrient that can do that. And animal studies demonstrate reduced oxidative stress and amyloid B peptide deposition within that person. It will work also for Parkinson's, the second most common age-related disorder in the world. And like Alzheimer's, it's the result of pizzas, hamburgers, pretzels, all that fast food, coffee. It does it. It triggers production of abnormal inflammatory proteins. And in Parkinson's, the protein is called an alpha-synuclein, which damages neurons in regions of the brain that control motor function as well as cognition. Slow movements, weakness, cognitive impairment, eventually dementia. And Q10 is really, really important. I wouldn't even think of starting someone at less than 500 milligrams a day in divided doses Q10 and building up to probably 3,000, because you want to combat mitochondrial decline. You want to feed the mitochondria. And when you do that, you've got all the wonderful things happening in the brain, and otherwise you wouldn't. It can help fight migraines and major depression. So just look at coenzyme Q10 as being one of the single most important nutrients you could take into your body every day. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Noll. In a little bit, we're going to hear from our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series. Dr. Loretta Napoliani will be talking with her in London. But right now, let us hear from Senator Elizabeth Warren on an issue that is so important. It rarely gets attention. I want the people in this audience to hear what she has to say on this issue.
Mr. President, I rise in support of the Truth in Settlements Act. This bipartisan legislation, which I introduced earlier today with my colleague from Oklahoma, Senator Lankford, the president sitting here, will help the public hold federal agencies accountable for settlements they make with corporate wrongdoers. When companies break the law, federal enforcement agencies are responsible for holding them accountable. In nearly every instance, agencies choose to resolve cases through settlements rather than a public trial. They defend this practice by arguing that settlements are in the best interests of the American people. And that sounds good, but their actions paint a very different picture. If agencies were truly confident that these settlements were good deals for the public, they would be willing to disclose publicly all of the key details of those agreements. Instead, time after time, agencies do the opposite, hiding critical details about their settlements in the fine print, or worse, hiding them entirely from public view. Consider copies of these agreements, or even basic facts about them, are not easily accessible online. Many agencies regularly deem agreements confidential without any public explanation of why the public can't see what's been done in their name. And when agencies do make public statements about these agreements, they often trumpet large dollar amounts of money recovered for taxpayers, while failing to disclose that this sticker price isn't what the companies will actually pay, since the number that's listed includes credits for engaging in routine activities and doesn't reflect massive tax deductions that many of these companies get. Add up all of these tricks and you'll end up with a predictable result. Too often, the American people learn only what the agencies want them to learn about these agreements. That is not good enough. These hidden details can make a huge difference. Below the surface, settlements that seem tough and fair don't always look so impressive. For example, 2 years ago, federal regulators entered into a settlement with 10 mortgage servicers accused of illegal foreclosure practices. The sticker price on the settlement was $8.5 billion. Now, that is a big number. But $5.2 billion was in the form of credits for what the agencies described in their press release as, quote, loan modifications and forgiveness of deficiency judgments. That vague public statement left out a key detail. Servicers could rack up those credits by forgiving mere fractions of large unpaid loans. For example, a servicer that wrote down $15,000 of a $500,000 unpaid loan balance would get a credit for $500,000, not the $15,000 that was actually written down. That undisclosed method of calculating credits could end up cutting the overall value of the $8.5 billion settlement by billions and billions of dollars. Failure to disclose possible tax deductions is another way agencies can hide the ball. 2 years ago, a federal court found that a company allegedly defrauded Medicare and other federal health programs for years was entitled to a $50 million tax deduction for government settlements that it had made. That deduction came on top of earlier tax deductions the company had already taken in their settlement payment. The end result, a $385 million settlement that was touted at the time as the largest civil recovery to date in a healthcare fraud case, was in fact $100 million smaller once taxpayers had picked up part of the settlement. At least in these two cases, the text of the settlements was public, allowing the American people the chance to dig into the fine print and uncover these unflattering details. But for settlements that are kept confidential, the public is kept entirely in the dark. Recently, Wells Fargo agreed to pay the Federal Housing Finance Agency $335 million for allegedly fraudulent sales of mortgage-backed securities to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. That's about 6% of what J.P. Morgan Chase paid in a public settlement with FHFA to address very similar claims. Now, in what ways did the actions of Wells Fargo differ from those of J.P. Morgan? We'll never know, because while the J.P. Morgan settlement is public, the much smaller Wells Fargo settlement is held confidential. The American people deserve better. These enforcement agencies don't work for the companies they investigate. They work for us. Agencies should not be able to cut bad deals and then hide the embarrassing details. The public deserves transparency. The Truth in Settlements Act requires that transparency. It requires agencies making public statements about their settlements to include explanations of how those settlements are categorized for tax purposes and what specific conduct will generate credits that apply toward the sticker price. The bill also requires agencies to post text and basic information about their settlements online. And while the legislation does not prohibit agencies from deeming settlements confidential, it requires agencies to disclose additional information about how frequently they are invoking confidentiality and their reasons for doing so. If we expect agencies to hold companies accountable for breaking the law, then we should be able to hold agencies accountable for enforcing the law. If we can't, and we can't do that if we're being held in the dark. The Truth in Settlements Act shines a light on these agency decisions and gives the American people a chance to hold agencies accountable for enforcing our laws. I introduced this bill in the last Congress with Senator Lankford's predecessor, Senator Coburn. The bill advanced through the Senate's Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee by voice vote, but was blocked on the Senate floor. I hope that in this Congress, we can finally make this common sense legislation law. Thank you very much, Mr. President. I yield.
Just one of the issues that is not being addressed. Also, should we not begin to hold not just governmental agencies accountable, but also their employees? In that regard, I'd like to talk for a few moments before we go to our guest who's standing by in London to talk about a deeper look at the Islamic State's mission and the caliphate in postmodern political terms from Washington Blog. And we have to understand government corruption is absolutely rampant. For example, senior Securities and Exchange employees spent up to 8 hours a day surfing porn sites instead of cracking down on financial crimes. Nuclear Regulatory Commission workers watch porn instead of cracking down on unsafe conditions at nuclear plants. One EPA employee downloaded 7,000 porn files and spent 2 to 6 hours a day watching them, yet he was not fired, and he did it for years. And another EPA employee harassed 16 women co-workers and then was promoted to a higher-paying job with more responsibility, where, you guessed it, he harassed more women. The National Security Agency spies pass around homemade sexual videos and pictures that they've collected from spying on American people. Remember, anything you do in your bedroom, if you have a TV in the bedroom or a computer, they're watching you. They're recording it. And now we know they watch these. So you're making your own porn for the National Security Agencies. And by the way, they were just found to have been doing this illegally. Will anyone go to jail? Will anybody be held accountable? Absolutely not. Also, the National Security Agency employees have been caught using their mass surveillance powers to spy on love interests, such as girlfriends, obsessions with former wives, and to eavesdrop on American soldiers' intimate conversations with their wives back home. So every soldier who calls from a foreign port, your conversation is recorded and being listened to. And an employee of the Transportation Security Administration admitted that the TSA agents share and laugh at nude scans of passengers. Another TSA employee says that screeners make excuses they can grope and fondle travelers they're attracted to. Investigators from the Treasury Office of the Inspector General found that some of the regulators' employees surfed erotic websites, hired prostitutes, and accepted gifts from bank executives instead of actually working to help the economy. The Minerals Management Service, a regulator charged with overseeing British Petroleum and other oil companies to ensure that oil spills don't occur, was riddled with, quote, a culture of substance abuse, that's drugs, and promiscuity, which included sex with industry contacts. Also, agents for the department, the Drug Enforcement Agency, had dozens of sex parties with prostitutes hired by the drug cartels they were supposed to stop. That's right, our Drug Enforcement Agency, our DEA, dozens and dozens of sex parties, all paid for by the drug cartel leaders. They also received money, weapons, and gifts. Pentagon employees used government credit cards to pay for adult escorts, prostitutes, and to gamble. Federal agents with the Drug Enforcement Administration and Secret Service investigating Bitcoin money laundering extorted and stole over 1 million in the Bitcoin. The IRS gave promotions to employees who were themselves tax cheats. The Commodity Futures Trading Commission has conspired with big banks to manipulate commodity prices for decades. The government-sponsored rating agencies committed massive fraud. No one was held accountable. The Treasury Department allowed banks to fix their books. No one was held accountable. Regulators knew and allowed the use of debt-hiding accounting tricks by the big banks. The Secretary of the Treasury, Timothy Geithner, was complicit in Lehman's accounting fraud. The former chief accountant for the Securities and Exchange Commission says that Bernanke and Paulson broke the law and should be prosecuted. They won't be. The government knew about mortgage fraud a long time ago. For example, the FBI warned of an epidemic of mortgage fraud in 2004. However, the FBI, Department of Justice, and other governmental agencies then stood down and did nothing. For example, the Federal Reserve turned its cheek and allowed massive fraud. and the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, has repeatedly ignored accounting fraud. Indeed, Alan Greenspan took the position that fraud could never happen. Paulson and Bernanke falsely stated the big banks received TARP money were healthy. They were not. They lied. The Treasury Secretary also falsely told Congress that the bailouts would be used to dispose of toxic assets, but then used the money for something entirely else, buying other banks, buying their competitors. A high-level Federal Reserve official says quantitative easing, quote, is the greatest backdoor Wall Street bailout of all times, $21 trillion at zero interest. The Securities and Exchange Commission has been shredding Wall Street documents for decades to help the big banks cover up their fraud. The nonpartisan government accounting office calls the Fed, quote, corrupt and riddled with conflicts of interest. Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz says the World Bank would view any country which had a banking structure like the Federal Reserve as being corrupt and untrustworthy. The former vice president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas said he worried that the failure of the government to provide more information about the rescue spending could signal corruption. Arguably, both Bush and Obama administrations broke the law by refusing to close insolvent banks. Congress also covered up illegal tax breaks for the big banks. Police have been busting and framing innocent people every day all over America for years. Warmongers in the U.S. government knowingly and intentionally lied to us into a war of aggression against Iraq. None have been held accountable. The former head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the highest-ranking military officer in the United States, said the Iraq war was, quote, based on a series of lies. The same is true of Libya and Syria. $8.5 trillion in taxpayer money doled out by Congress to the Pentagon since 1996 has never been accounted for. The military wastes or loses trillions of dollars, and Congress pushes expensive boondoggles, including Bernie Sanders, who's just in there for the moment to build up a lead for Hillary, and then he'll back out, and she'll get elected. And the government lied when it said it doesn't conduct massive surveillance on Americans. It does, has. In fact, our government is incapable of ever telling the truth about anything. I'm not even willing to accept that the government could tell you what day of the week it is. The government also lied when it said America doesn't torture. We do and have. And then lied once again when it said torture was aimed at protecting America against terrorists. No, we're the terrorists. The government made sure that false claims were made about the amount of oil spilled in the British petroleum mess to protect them. The government has framed whistleblowers with false evidence, but never gone after any of the corrupt people that the whistleblowers was blowing the whistle on. The only people ever indicted or put in jail are the whistleblowers. How ironic is that? Even the dumbest of the dumb can wrap their mind around that. You show corruption, you go to jail. The people who were corrupt, they smile, wave, and get another paycheck. When one of the most respected radiologists in America, the former head of the radiological department at Yale University, attempted to blow the whistle on the fact that the FDA had approved a medical device manufactured by General Electric because it put out massive amounts of radiation, the FDA installed spyware to record his private emails and surfing activities, including installing cameras to snap pictures of his screen and then use the information to smear him. In an effort to protect Bank of America from the threatened WikiLeaks expose of wrongdoing, the Department of Justice told Bank of America to hire a specific hardball-playing law firm to assemble a team to take down WikiLeaks. We know that the Justice Department is completely corrupt, always has been. The Bush White House worked hard to smear CIA officers and bloggers and anyone else who criticized the Iraq war. Corruption at the FBI lab led to the execution of scores of innocent people. Not a single person is willing to come forward, even after proving that they are corrupt, incompetent, stupid, and vile. Well, that's, I guess, how you get, that's a qualification that actually gets you a job. The FBI smeared top scientists who pointed out that numerous holes in the anthrax case. Indeed, the head of the FBI's investigation agrees that corruption was rampant. Terror attacks such as 9/11, the Boston Marathon, and bombing, and the Texas shooting happen in part because of the massive pervasion of corruption in our intelligence agency. And fracking companies can dump 3 billion gallons of highly toxic water into California's drinking water supply. Nothing happens. And U.S. military contractors have pocketed huge sums of money earmarked for humanitarian and reconstruction aid. Nothing happens. Monsanto has claimed for decades that Roundup is safe, but the World Health Organization just said that it's a probable cause of cancer. Monsanto forbids independent scientists from testing its GMO crops for safety. It attacks the computers of people who oppose GMO foods and sue small farmers. Big farmers are drenching their crops with Roundup right before harvest. Big food companies work hand in glove with the government to dish out unhealthy food. British Petroleum's criminal negligence led to the giant Gulf oil spill. The real problem is we need to learn a little history. We've known for a long time when criminals are not punished, crime spreads. Yet we're willing to take someone who jaywalks or someone who jumps a turnstile or someone who's done nothing wrong and put them in jail, and the people who are the hardcore criminals in those gated communities and your hedge fund managers, your equity partners, and we praise them. How ironic is that? I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome you from all over the world. For those of you who are listening live each Sunday now, since I'll be back in New York later tonight after a long time on the road doing all the work I do, I look forward to be back in the city. I'll be in Central Park with the Running and Walking Club starting our first run to get people in shape. And don't not come because you're not in shape. The whole idea is to get you in shape. It's free. It's a public service. Been doing it for a long time. 90th Street and 5th Avenue, right inside Central Park at 9 o'clock Sunday morning. Let's say hello to Dr. Loretta Napoleoni. She is over in London. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you for inviting me again.
By the way, she's also a Fulbright Scholar at Johns Hopkins School of International Studies and holds a master's in philosophy and a doctorate in economics and is published in The Guardian, La Mode, and others. And she has a very important book, The Islamic Phoenix, The Islamic State in the Redrawing of the Middle East. For most Americans, and even the pundits in the U.S. media, ISIS is being perceived as only another jihadist terror organization on par with Al-Qaeda or other jihadist groups. However, as you have detailed, there is far more behind the motives and goal of ISIS than that does not have a modern precedent. This is an organization that is determined to create a nation, and therefore all the acts of terrorism we hear about are only one part, albeit essential to their success, to create a new caliphate as a modern nation that could reshape the map of the Middle East. So please first speak on the other strategies ISIS is engaged in and parallel to its militarist activities, such as deep understanding of the psychology behind globalization, its use of modern technology, social reform, its operations on business to generate revenue, and a need to create an apparatus to put into place national security like any other nation. The forum is yours.
Well, I think what we do not understand is that the Islamic State is much, much more than Al-Qaeda, for example, or any other Islamic organization. But also is much more than what we see on social media, you know, the beheading, the incredible violence. In reality, it is a strategy to project this kind of image to scare us, because one of the first tasks of a terrorist organization, it is to scare people. So you know, the more you terrorize, the better it is, because, you know, people believe that you're much stronger. But the real strength of the Islamic State is somewhere else. It's actually this mix of modernity, so the use of social media, the use of videos, the production also of incredibly sleek, very effective videos, and the nationalistic message that is launching to Muslims across the world, especially young people. I mean, Europe, for example, is a very interesting place because there are a lot of young Muslims. Some of them actually moved here after 2003, after the beginning of the invasion of Iraq. So they grew up in the West. They went to school in the West, but they don't belong to the West. They feel misfit. At the same time, they do not belong to the country where they're coming from, to the country of their parents, although they were educated. I mean, the culture that these people assimilated at home was, of course, a Muslim culture. So these people are lost, I mean, really lost souls. And most of them are actually very bright. It's interesting to see that the response among the highly educated people, in particular women, is much higher than the response that we get from less educated women or young men. So why is the Islamic State so successful in seducing these people? Well, the answer is that religion has become a sort of ideology, a nationalistic ideology. So while they send us the message of terror, they send these other people, the Muslim, a very seductive message, which is the creation of a new nation, the creation of the nation that their fathers, grandfathers, all their ancestors have been dreaming of. It is a recurrent pattern in Muslim culture, the search for a political expression, so the search for a nation. And of course, this has never succeeded because, we've seen that we had colonization first, then we had through the decolonization, we had the birth of dictatorship, absolute monarchies, corrupted elites which run this part of the world. So every single Muslim has been brought up in families listening to this dream. And then all of a sudden, Islamic State comes and says, well, we're doing it, and we need you, we want you. You come here, this is going to be your nation, you're going to be the founding fathers of this nation, you're going to have an identity, you're going to have a family. So we'll give you a clear path of life, which of course is something you don't have where you are. So that is the really strong strength of the Islamic State, which of course you can't destroy by bombing people. But we don't want to admit it. I mean, I say we, talking about politicians, because of course the moment in which we say this is an organization which has morphed into a state based upon a nationalistic kind of narrative, things change completely. We prefer to say, oh, this is just another al-Qaeda, these are just other religious fanatics, because of course the religious fanatics is less strong, but also the religious fanatics can be easily dismissed as insane, while of course a nationalistic well-organized plan is something very, very serious.
If you were to reorganize the Middle East right now, if we did not have Americans in bases in Saudi Arabia or other places like Kuwait, Bahrain, what we do, if we had not invaded Iraq, if we had allowed the Arab League and the nations to work with Israel in a peaceful resolution and to have a two-state nation, one for Palestinians and one for Israel, do you believe that we would have an ISIS today?
No, I think ISIS is very much the product of the invasion of Iraq. And even more, I would say that it is the product of the lies which have been produced to invade Iraq. I mean, the origin, the genesis of ISIS is al-Turkawi, this group called Tuaid al-Jihad. We know today that everything Colin Powell said at the Security Council in February 2003 was false. Al-Zarqawi was not a member of Al-Qaeda. He was not tool, the link between Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein. He was actually a very small jihadist leader who had a very small group called, you know, Tuaid al-Jihad, which was, of course, a radical Salafist group. So they perceived the Sunni as, you know, enemies, people that had to be destroyed to go back to the purity of Islam. But, of course, the moment in which he was presented to the world as the number one man in Iraq of Al-Qaeda, money started flowing there. So all of a sudden, this became, you know, a self-fulfilling prophecy, basically. All of a sudden, al-Zarqawi could command a very large group of people. Now, among those people, there was al-Baghdadi, who is now the leader of the Islamic State, but also several other people who are at the top, say, of the organizational pyramid of the Islamic State. Now, if we had not done that, these people would not exist. So I think it's tragic. I think it's paradoxical, but above all, it's tragic. And nobody has paid for that. You see, I mean, all those people lie.
Loretta, no one's going to pay for it, except the people in the Middle East, with all this stupid bombing, because you do not bomb a philosophy into submission. No. We should have learned that from North Vietnam.
Yeah.
I just put two photographs up on my website. One shows Libya before we invaded it, the most sophisticated and the highest standard of living in Africa, even more so than South Africa. Mm-hmm. And then after the bombing, which is now not just a failed state, but it's a complete breeding ground for ISIS, Al-Qaeda, al-Nusra, and all the other terrorist organizations, and we have taken no responsibility. The war hawks, the Hillary Clintons, Obamas, all the people who demanded it, French, the Cameron, no one stepped forward saying, you know, we got this wrong. What we chose to do, we better learn a lesson from it. Look at Iraq. Look at Syria. The Syrians were rebelling not because of the government initially. It was because of the failed wheat harvest from the droughts. And instead of going in there and helping to supplement their diets, because it was the breadbasket of that whole area of the world, instead we sponsored the terrorist groups because we wanted a changed nation. We were looking to change all this. So when you look in Iraq, and you look in Afghanistan, and you look in Libya, and you look in Syria, you see how we've mismanaged this, and what we say we don't want, we actually create, because there's extended families. Many of the families have 40 extended members. So if you end up killing 1 million people, you've just impacted 40 million people. If you've displaced 5 million of them who are refugees in their own country or outside of the country, you've impacted more people than live in the country. So everyone's going to have something bad to say about you, and the likelihood that the next young kid coming up that's living in poverty, who doesn't have 3 hours a day of electricity, whose family is now being hunted down because they're Shia or they're Sunni and the other wants to kill them and there's no one protecting them, that's a person likely to join one of these ISIS groups. We don't seem to have the ability to understand the deeper consequences to wrong choices. Would you address these, please?
Oh, absolutely. I agree 100% with you that we do not have this ability. But it's not that we, the people, do not have this ability. It is that somebody has taken away our right to exercise this kind of ability. I mean, in the old days, people would do the honorable thing. So, you know, you did something wrong, and you would apologize, and you would, of course, pay for it. I mean, this is what good politician should be. Now, of course, lying to the nation, not lying to the people, lying to Congress and to the world, it's a crime. I mean, and we are paying the consequences of this crime. I am pretty sure that if things had been different, if we had exposed those lies, if those people who have lied had been put on trial in the Hague, and I'm not talking only about Colin Powell, of course, you know, he was Secretary of State, but you know, I'm talking about Bush, I'm talking about Blair. I mean, if we had done something like that, possibly these young people, they're leaving Europe, these young Muslims, they're going there to become, you know, fighters or to become, you know, wives of these fighters, would not do that. They wouldn't. I mean, because they would feel that justice would really exist in our society. They would find our society a good place to live. But of course, it's all a hypocritical attitude towards, you know, our politicians. It's all about criminalizing people that are actually victims. Because, you know, we're bombing. We are actually bombing innocent people. I mean, I've seen picture of children being, you know, killed by the drones. And now we know that it's very difficult with the drones to know who you're bombing, because, you know, it's a video game. So I find this extraordinary. So how do we expect Muslims to accept this abysmal behavior that we're having? I mean, you know, we don't accept it ourselves, because, you know, we belong to the group of people that find this shocking. So that doesn't, of course, justify what the Islamic State is doing, but it gives you an idea of why this message of the Islamic State is so strong, why it's appealing to people that have degrees from universities in Europe. I mean, I just did a small research about these women that go, I mean, these jihadist brides. And a lot of the British that have gone, they were A-star students, several. They wanted to study medicine because they wanted to help people. So, and now they're probably, you know, living in Raqqa, producing kids to populate this new nation, cover head to toes. How is it possible? How is it possible? And then you realize that the reason why they do that is because they do want to build a better society, because they find our society hypocritical. They don't like our society.
Finally, when you look at Saudi Arabia, without question, one of the most repressive, undemocratic, inhumane terrorist states in the history of the world, and they're the primary funders of virtually all the major terrorism in the Middle East, and we know that. Our National Security Agency knows that. We monitor every phone call, every email, every banking transaction. But because we're selling them tens of billions of dollars in weaponry and systems and buying their oil, and they're still trading oil for dollars, that clouds our objectivity. So how can we, with any sense of objectivity, say we're concerned about the war on terror when the people who are our partners economically are sponsoring the war on terror?
Well, absolutely. If we look at the sponsor of the Islamic State initially, when they cross over to Syria at the beginning of the civil war, of course, you know, Saudi Arabia was right there. So this is a sort of Frankenstein, really. This is, again, hypocritical. This is it's double standards. Something that we should not allow this to happen. And by the way, you know, we're so horrified by the way the Islamic State is punishing people inside this Islamic State. So beheading of people that, for example, for homicide or stealing, people get, you know, one hand cut off, things like that. Well, yeah, Saudi Arabia does it all the time. I mean, in Saudi Arabia, there's been the Sharia law imposed from the beginning. So every Friday, they chop the head off to several people. And they do it in a public square so the people can go and watch. It is horrific. And these are our allies. These are the people that we deal with. To the point that, you know, when the new king was came to power, President Obama and his wife went to visit him to pay homage to his people. So it is unbelievable, the double standards. And of course, you know, people in the Muslim world, you know, look at that and say, well, that's the West. I mean, the West has always been like this. These are the colonizers. These are the people that oppress us. And if I have to choose, this is what they think, I may actually go with this new phenomenon, with this new nationalistic phenomenon.
Also, Loretta, we're out of time, and frequently they don't have a choice. Because when the ISIS invades a country like northern Iraq, every single village it went to, you either had to agree to convert to their religious ideology or you were killed. And that includes Christians as well. So it's not a matter of someone saying, I may not like America, but my God, I don't have a choice here. And they are completely psychopathic. But what we have not done in America is we've never had an exhale break where we look and say, how did we allow this? What do we do to contribute to this? What have our allies done? How can we change this? Because you're not going to win against ISIS by bombing them. You're going to have to, at some point, you're going to have to bring all the religious leaders of the Middle East together, and they are going to have to sort this out based upon their traditions, their culture, their values, not ours. That's my view.
No, absolutely. What we need to do is also to prevent these young people from going there. So we have to integrate them. We have to give them a better future here.
Yeah, well, we can't even have a future for most of the people right now. Dr. Loretta Napoleoni, thank you for being on with us.
Thank you very much.
And she is the chairwoman of the Club of the Club de Madrid. She holds degrees in economics. She's a Fulbright scholar from Johns Hopkins School of International Studies. She's a heavyweight, and her new book is The Islamic Phoenix. She's giving us a different perspective on the Islamic State, how we created it, and how Saudi Arabia and Jordan and other countries fund it. And all the drones in the world, all the bombing, are just going to kill a lot of innocent people. And how do you think that's going to turn out? I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program.